Nobel Prize has been awarded for 125 years. Is the prize being awarded in the way it was intended? Is it good for science, or are there drawbacks? Astrophysicist Brian Keating almost won the Nobel Prize. His book is called Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor.
Well, I'd say that it's a journey into the heart of what it means to be a scientist. You know, people ask me, who is this book for? And I say, it's for anyone who hasn't won a Nobel Prize or hasn't won a Grammy or hasn't won an Oscar. Anyone who's aspired to great things and has along the way perhaps not gotten into his or her personal promised land, so to speak.
It's time for Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network and the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Shuck.
There is no greater confirmation of one's intelligence than the Nobel Prize. I mean, there's no Academy Award that comes close. There's no, you know, even being the president doesn't confer the same status as being a Nobel Prize winner in terms of intellect. And you see this quite frequently. You see that 70 Nobel Prize winners will come out and tell folks who they should vote for, or, you know, not to eat GMO, or, you know, or whatever. And, you know,
it is not unusual to have a Nobel Prize winner write a book. But what about those who lose the Nobel Prize? Not too many write that book. Dr. Brian Keating did. He's an astrophysicist who teaches at the University of California at San Diego. He almost won the Nobel Prize, but not quite. His book is called Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. Professor Brian Keating is an astrophysicist with UC San Diego's Department of Physics. He and his team develop instrumentation to study the early universe at radio, microwave, and infrared wavelengths. He's the author of over 100 scientific publications and holds 2 U.S. patents. In 2007, he won the Presidential Early Career Award for scientists and engineers at the White House from President Bush. Why? He invented and developed a telescope at the U.S. South Pole Research Station called BICEP. Welcome, Dr. Keating, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
This book covered a lot of ground here. It's like a history of cosmology. It's a spiritual quest. It's a question about science, how it's done well and how sometimes it isn't. What else is this book about?
Well, I'd say that it's a journey into the heart of what it means to be a scientist. You know, people ask me, who is this book for? And I say it's for anyone who hasn't won a Nobel Prize or hasn't won a Grammy or hasn't won an Oscar, anyone who's aspired to great things and has along the way perhaps not gotten into his or her personal promised land, so to speak.
It's also about the Nobel Prize. Alfred Nobel, the patron saint for people who like to blow stuff up, and the literal patron of the Nobel Prize. Let's go back and talk about him. What did Alfred Nobel do to make his fortune, and when and how and why did he set up this prize?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, Alfred Nobel, not too many people know the truth about him. They seem to know more, you know, kind of fables and folklore about him than actual truth. That I discuss in the book as well, but essentially he was the son of a very mercurial father who is also an inventor who had started basically an international arms dealership in Scandinavia, and the main customer of the Nobel and Sons products, which were landmines and sea mines, was the Russian military. And the Russian military in the late, you know, mid 1800s. Sort of got tired and pushed the pause button on their military expansion, You know, be interesting to see Putin's take on doing such a thing nowadays. He seems hell-bent on continuing it, so too bad for Nobel that they're not still selling mines. But the father sort of went broke and went bankrupt and transferred ownership of the company to his eldest son, to Ludwig. And Ludwig basically ran it into the ground. And what ended up happening was it basically drove – the father had a nervous breakdown and had a stroke and really was never the same again. So he really, you know, bet on Russian pacifism, which is, you know, bet against Russian pacifism, I should say, which is usually a safe bet. But in this case, it wasn't. So the son, he had seven sons, I believe, and a couple of daughters, and all but three of them three of them had died before the age of 22. And the one that sort of had the biggest impact on Alfred Nobel, the patron saint of the Nobel Prize, was the his youngest brother, Emil, who was trying to invent basically a form of liquid or stabilized nitroglycerin that could be used in faraway expansions of the United States railway plans and other construction projects in Europe and abroad. And in the process of trying to develop a version of what would later become dynamite, dropped this chemical compound that he was synthesizing and blew himself up and killed a couple people and injured others in the laboratory that they were working on, which is the family's villa outside of Stockholm. And this had a huge – it was really put his father, Alfred's father, you know, completely over the top. And he really never regained his sanity. And then it seems as if Alfred went on a quest to develop a version of a stabilized form of explosive that in some ways would redeem not only his brother's, his younger brother's, baby brother's life, but also posthumously in some sense redeem the Nobel name, because the prize would be – or sorry, the chemical compound, which later became known as dynamite, was eventually used for a great many purposes that were not involved with destruction but rather construction. So it's really fascinating how it was really born out of the ashes, this great wealth, this great fortune. And then Alfred Nobel chose not to do philanthropy while he was alive, but then in his will endowed in what I claim is the most famous final testament in such a way as to provide benefit to humanity after his death. And that would come in the form of prizes annually distributed that bettered mankind. And so that's part of the catechism of the Nobel mission. And I feel in some ways it's gone astray from that. So yes, I do spend a fair amount of the book as a gentle Jeremiah against the Nobel Prize process's deviations from what Alfred Nobel wanted so virtuously 125 years ago.
And that's how long it's been, has it? 125 years of prizes?
Yeah, well, he wrote down his will. You know, he was banished from France, where he loved living, and he was banished to San Remo, Italy, because the French and the Italians were basically in a constant state of argument, if not actual live hot war. And so they forced him out of Paris. He snuck back into Paris in 1895, only a few years after reading his own obituary, which is a rare treat, you know, that you get to read your own obituary. Of course, I say in the book, it was really his older brother, Ludwig, who had died. And the Parisian newspapers wrote an obituary that said the merchant of death is now dead. And it really shocked Alfred Nobel, because they thought Alfred Nobel had died, but it was Ludwig, the one who had run the company into the ground 30 years earlier. And what he did was sort of this, you know, kind of gift that, you know, Ebenezer Scrooge or, you know, one of these characters in A Christmas Carol will get, where they get a second chance at life. And then in their rebirth, courtesy of this, you know, of this incorrect obituary, Alfred Nobel decided he would endow these prizes in 1895. And then he died the year after. This was quite amazing how fast it happened. And then the first Nobel Prizes were awarded in 1901. And it was kind of swept up in this, you know, fin de siècle, you know, dreams for a world that would be, you know, arching towards peace and prosperity and kindness between all nations that, you know, we still have yet to materialize.
I'm speaking with Brian Keating. He's the author of Losing the Nobel Prize, a story of cosmology, ambition, and the perils of science's highest honor. We want to talk later a bit more about what the Nobel Prize has done to science and your possible suggestions for it. But let's go to you. And the thing about the Nobel Prize is that it really is what? It is the chief end of all science, almost. And yeah. So it's what I get from your book. I mean, it's like you write yourself that demigod status is delivered upon those who are recipients of the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, within the world of physics, you learn very early because of the way that you're taught. It's very conscious that you're really taught science, not in the historical passage, but how history tells the story is, you know, history is written by the victors, and the victors of science are the Nobel Prize winners, because they actually, you know, are the only scientists that any, you know, lay person can name. And the achievements that they accomplish, you know, they're really elevated to the status. As I say, there's more, you know, people that have been on the space shuttle or been on the space station that are alive than there are living Nobel Prize winners in physics. So it's a really small, you know, fraternity. And I use that word deliberately, as you probably have guessed from the book. It's mostly been won by men and only two women in 107 and over 116 years.
Yeah, there's a wonderful statistic you put in there about how many popes there have been versus Nobel Prize winners, and only two more women and Nobel Prize winners than there have been women popes.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, I mean, we learn very early on to worship these heroes. And I make no complaints in the book, as you probably could tell, about the winners who have won it, you know, the Einsteins, the Feynmans, the most recent winners that, you know, I was tangentially involved with selecting in the last couple of years. So I really don't have a problem with the winners of it. They're sort of the bystanders in a way, and they benefit greatly, I mean, tremendously, and they suffer tremendously too. There's a famous quote by T.S. Eliot, where he says, the Nobel Prize is a ticket to one's own funeral because no one's ever done anything with it after he won it. And it's really, you know, kind of an unending stream of donor dinners and getting trotted out on committees and so forth once you do win. And I have had many colleagues and friends, as you see in the book, who have won it, and, you know, I'm very happy for them, but you know, it always comes with that kind of twinge of foreboding that, you know, I must suspect that, say, an Oscar winner feels or a lottery winner, you know, how often does it turn out that to have, you know, ruinous effects as often as it does turn out to have these, you know, very valorous and loving and wonderful effects.
And it drives, as I'm reading your book, it really, from the very beginning of a person who decides I'm going to have a career in physics, it really drives, in a sense, the vision. Let me ask it, and let me put that to a question to you. To what extent did the Nobel Prize kind of drive you in terms of becoming a student of physics and then a professor and a research scientist?
Very much. I mean, I was influenced in the early days by, you know, just obviously a fascination with Albert Einstein, and then Richard Feynman and Linus Pauling and all these just titanic intellects that I literally, you know, worshipped. I mean, I had, you know, and I still do in my daughter's room. I have a poster of Maria Mayer, the last woman to win the Nobel Prize in 1963. You know, and I never had sports stars on my walls. It was always scientists, Isaac Newton. You know, one of my sons is named after him. So, you know, science was always this incredibly just revered a source of knowledge and just the achievement of the pinnacle of human achievement in my mind. You know, I was never really great at sports and everything else, you know, to boot. And I wasn't going to be an actor, certainly. So to me, the thing that I wanted most to aspire to was to be a great scientist. And also, you could probably tell that, you know, scientists to really achieve at a level that's kind of puts you in the running for a Nobel Prize, as I was several years ago, you know, you have to get really good grades. You have to be very well versed in math and physics and all other disciplines that are pertinent, public speaking and communication and writing and so forth. And when you get that kind of mentality, that type A mentality, that's a mentality that really seeks the ultimate, you know, grade and scoring and confirmation of your intelligence. And there is no greater confirmation of one's intelligence than the Nobel Prize. I mean, there's no Academy Award that's comes close. There's no, you know, even being the president doesn't confer the same status as being a Nobel Prize winner in terms of intellect. And you see this quite frequently. You see that 70 Nobel Prizes prize winners will come out and tell folks who they should vote for, or, you know, not to eat GMO, or, you know, or whatever. And, you know, and that's just kind of betokens how their esteem has risen so much. And I don't think Alfred Nobel or the early winners, some of whom didn't show up in the early 1900s to collect their Nobel Prize in physics. And to me, the culmination was, you know, about 20 or 30 years ago, a Nobel Prize winner by the name of Shockley. He had some pretty shocking views on ethnicity and race and eugenics. And he actually proposed that blacks be encouraged, African Americans be encouraged to sterilize themselves. This is a man who won the Nobel Prize for co-inventing the transistor. And he went on to such great heights as to, you know, create basically the first and only of its kind Nobel Prize sperm bank. And I don't know if anyone ever made any withdrawals from it, but it was right here in northern San Diego County. And the thought was that by having this prize-winning seed, so to speak, from these winners, that society over time, along with the eugenics of African Americans, you know, you have to do that, that society be made better. And it's just so – it was just such a shocking thing. And yet nobody really paid much attention to it. But I think it does belie the fact. I mean, he was just, you know, kind of had some despicable views. But I do think, you know, at some level, this notion of that people would want a Nobel Prize sperm bank is just so ridiculous to me. And yet, you know, they say, you know, some things are only so foolish that only an intellectual could believe them.
My guest, if you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, is Brian Keating. He's the author of Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. So let's go to your story a little bit. I first of all, I have to say that being a cosmologist would be the coolest thing in the world on the planet. Yeah. Regardless of whether there are prizes involved. I mean, in some level. And that's really what your heart was, wasn't it? As a 13-year-old looking up at the stars in your first telescope?
Yeah, I always wanted to do hair and makeup. And so cosmology was a natural – no, it's funny. I talk in the book, you know, that people always ask me, you know, either, you know, what's my horoscope, you know, for them. and I used to kind of laugh it off and say, well, I'm not an astrologer. I'm an astronomer. But now I just say, oh, well, what are – oh, you're a Pisces? Oh, ooh, it's terrible. I would stay home all next week, you know. Or, you know, oh, you're very gullible or something, you know. It was something to make them feel like they got a free reading from a professional astrologer. It's quite a kick. But it's true. Cosmology and cosmetology share this prefix, cosm, which means appearance. And it's the appearance of your face, or, you know, a beauty parlor kind of appearance. But it's also the face that the cosmos presents to us. And so from an early my early childhood as a teenager, I got my first telescope. And I really have never, you know, it wasn't really my first love. It was really the first thing, you know, visual, sensory, sensuous thing that I could imagine being in love with. And the more I understood it, the more I understood the mathematics, the complexities of it, the intricacies of how the universe is structured and how deep it goes, the more and more fascinated I became. And so I never really thought I could be an astronomer. I always thought it was like being a wizard. You know, who's going to pay me to be an astronomer? I'd have to pay you to do that. And I would have paid. But, you know, don't tell my boss, Jerry Brown, that I would pay instead of being paid as a University of California professor. So I feel like it's a natural science for people to fall in love with. You know, people can hate politicians, they can hate, you know, certain economic structures, but nobody looks up at the night sky with the two telescopes that they're born with and says, oh, I hate the, you know, it's fascinating. And we've all wondered, you know, why does the moon follow us? Why do the patterns change appearance? And it's no surprise that the earliest images, you know, were depicted by petroglyphs were really images of what was happening in the skies and the stars above. It was the great, you know, silent Netflix of prehistory. And now I have the great privilege to do this and to train future scientists to follow their passion in this exact same field. It's such a privilege.
And the book that you have is this great mix of a number of different things. But one is the history of astronomy itself and how it changes and some of the big questions. Can you Tell us what the question that was really driving you. Yeah. If you can say it on the radio to people who have no idea what science is, like myself.
Yeah, I can certainly do that. So the thing that I found to be so fascinating was that we've had throughout history vacillations in how important we think we are as a species, or how important we think the Earth is to the existence of the cosmos. So for most of prehistory, the ancient Greeks up until, you know, the 1500s, the late 1500s, most human beings thought the entire cosmos was centered on the Earth. And in fact, it looks that way. And if you try to, you know, if I asked you to prove that the Earth is not the center of the solar system, if you're not a scientist, it's pretty darn difficult to do that. Just as if I asked you to prove the Earth is not flat. It looks flat, it sure does. And actually, you can use flat, you know, maps that are basically based on a flat surface of the Earth being a very good approximation to the spherical Earth that we live on. So many people thought we were the center of the Earth. We thought we were the center of the solar system. For a long period of time, cosmologists thought we were the center of the galaxy. And then later, we thought we were the center of the universe, because in each case, the universe sort of conspires against our the logical explanation, and actually presents an illusion that we are centered on, that the universe is centered on us. It does appear that things revolve around us. It appears when you're out in the middle of the ocean that the ocean is centered on you. But these are all illusions, and they all played upon a very human notion, which is a psychological bias that all human beings have. And scientists, despite the stereotypes to the contrary, are human beings. And that psychological bias that we have is called confirmation bias, which is the tendency to believe evidence that comports with your preconceived notions and discard evidence that doesn't seem to agree with it. So even Einstein, who thought for many the first decades of his life, after winning the Nobel Prize, in fact, in 1922, he even believed the universe was static and unchanging and everlasting, until Hubble, you know, proved otherwise, that the universe was expanding and dynamic. And so there have been at least five different major episodes in the history of cosmology since the invention of the telescope in the late 1500s, early 1600s. When astronomers have been deceived into thinking we're the center of it all. And I keep saying that, and it's no surprise that this will continue to happen. We may believe that we are what life on other planets should look like. And in fact, you usually see some form of anthropomorphism when you see alien life depicted, whether that be that they're based on, you know, carbon-based life forms, or they have two eyes, or they, you know, about the same height as us, and they have, but that's also a sort of a confirmation bias revelation, in that there's no reason, you know, necessarily, that life couldn't be completely different from what we look like. So I urge people in this book not to fall victim, or to at least obey, or, you know, observe themselves and take an accounting on themselves, to say, you know, what biases am I subject to? And those biases extended to an experiment that I was involved in called Bicep 2. And they extend into the halls of Stockholm, Sweden, where the Nobel Prize is conferred each year. And these biases, in some cases, are harmless. And in other cases, they're really invidious. And so the book is sort of a psychological history of cosmology, ascribing and discussing the various missteps and blunders that we took along the way, including my own.
I want to talk more about that, and I also want to talk about confirmation bias in the sense of how that relates to the competitive nature of science, and it seems to be its kind of siloing effect of isolating different teams here and there and almost individuals. How does this Nobel Prize really help or hurt this natural notion towards confirmation bias?
Yeah, I think that's a very astute thing to point out. So the Nobel Prize was set up, as I said, by Alfred Nobel to reward, in his will, he says he wants it to go to the person, i.e. a single person, who has conferred the greatest benefit to mankind by his or her, he doesn't say his or her, he says by their discovery or invention in the preceding year. So there's really three different clauses that I keyed into in this will. So I was asked to nominate – I should take a step back. I was asked to nominate the winners of the 2016 Nobel Prize, and it was just about a year after I had gone through a brush with, you know, potentially winning the Nobel Prize myself for this experiment called BICEP that claimed that we had detected the origin of the universe in a very unique and special way that I'll describe. But in this case, by 2016, I was asked to nominate other people, and I was told, you know, the rules stated I could not nominate myself, you know, so that really helped narrow down the field greatly. And when I thought about the process of nominating the winner of the Nobel Prize, you know, I'm an academic, you know, so my job is to look at sources and to read through citations. So the very first citation I thought of looking at was Alfred Nobel's will. And what I found in there was a handwritten will translated, thank goodness, from, you know, German into English online by the Nobel Committee themselves. And I found that he wanted a single person to win it for something they discovered in the preceding year that had the greatest benefit to mankind. And then the next thing I did is look back, well, what was the first Nobel Prize ever awarded? Because that was probably the closest one to Alfred Nobel's heart. And it was to Wilhelm Röntgen for the invention of Röntgen rays, which I know you know all about, but you'll recognize those are
Röntgen rays. That sounds fun. Yeah. That sounds like a mechanic would do. My brother has a wrench ranch. I'm not sure if that's the same thing.
Yeah, it could be similar, right? A nice plug. So these are X-rays. We call them now X-rays. But Röntgen discovered these X-rays a couple of weeks after, around the time that Alfred Nobel was writing down his will. And they made headlines around the world. They had an immediate benefit on all of mankind. They were used for medicine within days, and, you know, looking at cavities and broken bones and other things inside of the human body. And later, of course, you know, to treat acne and to measure your shoe size and all sorts of diabolical things we would never do nowadays. But, you know, that was sort of the paradigm. That was the archetypical sort of Nobel Prize, I think, that Alfred Nobel wanted. And then I thought, well, you know, what in my field of astronomy, presumably that was what they were interested, you know, has ever benefited mankind on that same scale? And even if you make the allowance for poetic license that, you know, it's the wonderment, the discovery, et cetera, you know, then you have to ask, well, when did that experiment take place, or when did that discovery take place? And there's really been no projects that have really been awarded a year later after making their discovery. I mean, these are, you know, scientific method has changed dramatically since Alfred Nobel's time. It's not done by a single person anymore. It's not done within a single year. And it sometimes doesn't confer the, you know, it's not meant to, in the physical pure sciences, the goal is not to, you know, improve medical conditions or whatever. That may happen as a byproduct, and that's great. And I don't have any qualms about the physicists who have won it for medical inventions, because I think those are wonderful. But the whole process made me question, well, what other things have they disavowed from Alfred Nobel's will? And I found, you know, a multitude of things where they've strayed. And I started to see them sort of as a, almost like the Vatican or something, the Swedish Royal Academy, and the way that they might have distorted a more pure message that as it was intended early on, and maybe covered up for their own, you know, their own modifications. And, you know, I call it in the book, the Swedish Royal Academy and the Nobel Prize itself is really one of the last and only and biggest monopolies of its kind. There's no close second to the Nobel Prize. And so it's no surprise that they want to protect their monopoly, as most monopolists want to do. So to me, the competition that gets engendered is really, you know, part of it was born by the specification of Alfred Nobel's will, and part of it is based on how the Nobel Committee chooses to interpret and then violate and then rewrite the will of the late Alfred Nobel.
And if you are using the metaphor of the Nobel Prize Committee as being kind of a church, then you are its heretic.
Yes, I am an apostate in the Church of Alfred Nobel. And I talk about that in the book, how it has all the hallmarks of a religion. I know that your show covers so many delightful topics of all religions, which is, I think, is a testament to your, you know, your faith, or maybe your absence of faith, or however you characterize yourself. But what I love about your show is that you have an ecumenical approach to things, and you treat all religions with respect, and even no religion with respect. But in the case of Alfred Nobel and the religion that I call Nobelism, it has all the hallmarks of any of the theologies and theologians that you may have interviewed in your many years on the radio. It has its patron saint, Alfred Nobel. It has its high priesthood, which are the Nobel committees in Stockholm and in Norway. And it has its patron saints, which are the winners, the laureates who win the prize. It has two holy days each year. When the Nobel Prize is announced and when the Nobel Prize is coronated and given away, the feast that takes place every year, a very macabre festival that takes place on Alfred Nobel's death day, not his birthday. with flowers imported from his tomb. It's a very interesting scatological ceremony, as I describe in the book.
And the prize is a golden calf itself.
The prize is literally a golden calf that sadly many of the most secular and rational humanists in the world bow down to it.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Dr. Brian Keating, an astrophysicist at the University of California, San Diego. We're discussing his book, Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. More to come. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm and click donate. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor is the book I'm discussing with its author, Dr. Brian Keating. So let's talk, Brian Keating, about your own story. I mean, this was pretty cool. You're checking out to see if you can take a picture. Going back to the science here. Of the beginning of the universe, right? There's these gravitational whatever, some kind of disturbance thing. Help me out with that stuff. But you're going to Antarctica to do this, and it looks like it could happen.
Yeah. So in early 2000s, sort of had an idea. I was influenced by two or three brilliant colleagues of mine who are theoreticians. I'm an experimentalist, which means I build different types of telescopes and detectors, and then we put them in very special locations. In this case, in the book, we take it to the place I took it to was the very south pole of the Earth, in Antarctica. And this is a small refracting telescope with lenses in it about the size, about 5 or 6 feet tall. And this telescope had an exquisite mission, which was to observe the universe's first flash of time. And in the first, trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, we believe that all the matter and all the energy, all the molecules, everything that was or ever would be, dark matter, dark energy included, was all compressed into almost an infinitesimal point. And that point, that volume, exploded forth. And some say it exploded so violently that it would have created aftershocks in its wake, like a boat moving through the water. And the faster the boat, the sort of faster the shock waves in the behind it. And so these waves of what are called gravitational waves of gravity, propagate through the universe, as Einstein declared, at the speed of light. And except they had never been directly detected until two and a half years ago now by the LIGO experiment. We thought that we captured their imprint, not today coming into our detectors. Our telescopes see only a form of light called microwaves, but our telescope could capture the existence of these waves of gravity back when the universe was first born. So when you look back in space, you're looking back in time. And if you look back where there's nothing in your way, no walls, no trees, nothing, no stars, no galaxies, you're looking back as far as light has had a time to travel. And so in that case, we looked between all the stars and we looked back to the very beginning of time, at an epoch when these gravitational waves, if they were present, would have indicated not only did the universe experience this violent expansion of space-time at speeds faster than the speed of light, but the universe would not necessarily be unaccompanied. It might not be a universe at all. It might be that what we call our universe is just a single blip in what's called a multiverse with thousands and millions and trillions and maybe an infinite number of other universes that are so far removed from us because of this expansion that we have no evidence of their existence. But the thought was that if we had detected these waves of gravity as we claimed that we did in 2014 at a press conference in Harvard, that was seen by millions around the world. If that discovery had been confirmed, that would have indicated the universe's ultraviolent birth and also opened up the doors to speculation as to whether or not our universe is really a universe after all.
And what you found was dust?
Yeah. So what ended up happening was we had done an exquisite measurement, and we had detected a signal that was billions of times smaller than, say, even the very cold temperatures of what we were surrounded by at the South Pole. So we detected a fluctuation in the fabric of space-time, we claimed, that was equivalent to detecting these waves of gravity from the universe's, you know, ultraviolet erupting birth force, bursting forth from potentially from nothing. And these waves that we saw make an imprint on the universe's oldest light. And that light's called the cosmic microwave background. And that light, if the universe is suffused with these waves of gravity, that light will acquire a type of twisting, curling pattern that is called B-mode polarization. It's not important to describe it. I do describe it in the book with a lot of diagrams, and I have some videos on my website as well to explain the physics behind it if people are interested. You know, one thing I did in my book is made it sort of a choose-your-own-adventure. If you're interested in the Nobel Prize, I have color-coded chapters on that. If you're interested in the science, there's chapters on that. If you're interested in the theology or the personal story, you know, you can choose your own adventure. So in the process of detecting these waves of gravity, we were concerned that we might be also subject to the appearance of an imposter signal produced not by the Big Bang, but by grains of dust, by, you know, cosmic schmutz, I call it, in our galaxy. So our galaxy is a collection of only 100 billion stars. And there's actually at least 100 billion other galaxies in the universe. Some are separated by billions of light years from our galaxy. And so we were aware of this signal that could mimic the signals that we were seeking. But that's the whole notion of confirmation bias, because we really were told from an early age, the early stage in this experiment, that if we detected it, we would win a Nobel Prize. And so while we were aware of the confounding properties of imposter signals masking or masquerading as the signal of inflation, we still were, you know, willing to go forward with the claim that we had detected this birth of the universe. And only later was it made clear to us that we had actually seen a signal that was as likely to be dust from our own Milky Way galaxy as it was to be waves of gravity from the universe's birth. So at that point, we had to basically retract and recant our claim. And the book describes the process of how we went through the agonizing, excruciating, soul-searching process before releasing the data, going public and getting great fanfare, and then the aftermath. And I think the aftermath is what is so interesting. It's sort of it informs us, and it wasn't that we made a blunder. You know, I say we didn't leave the lens cap on. We didn't, you know, forget to plug in the extension cord. We saw a signal that we have great confidence in to this day, but it's how you interpret it. And the interpretation is where the confirmation bias comes in.
But, you know, as I read your story, it was like this could have easily been avoided. Here I am saying easily been avoided if there was a way of you all working together and didn't have to win this prize to get the thing published before you were really quite ready.
Exactly. So that's part of the denunciation of the current status of this ultra competitive field that I describe in the book, that it's win at all cost, and it's getting there first means you win the Nobel Prize, because they've never gone back and said, well, actually, you know, this other group discovered this signal that we already awarded the Nobel Prize for. They were a couple days late, you know, even a month late, and we're going to give them the Nobel Prize. It's either contemporaneous and two teams discover exact same thing, or at the same time, or only one team wins and the other team loses. And I think that's a really kind of a disservice to science, because that's not the way science works. Science is, the meaning of the word science is knowledge, and knowledge is about collecting it, not what you get when you collect that knowledge.
So would you say that the way science is done in a practical matter, rather competitive, you're all competing for funds and there isn't enough funds. It's that small pyramid at the top, right? That the best yep. get the positions at the universities and the funding and all of this kind of stuff. Are there other models for the way science is done? Is there a collaborative model that would be better? Is the Nobel Prize, philosophically put it out there, is this a detriment to science or is it a boon?
I think in some ways it is, and I think people are afraid to talk about it. You know, it's like I don't really discuss it in the book, but in thinking about it, you know, there were a lot of people who benefited from somebody like Harvey Weinstein, right? They had great, you know, he controlled the studio. He could make your career. He could get you an Oscar. Meryl Streep called him God, you know, at some Academy Award acceptance speech that she had a few years back. So her agent.
More religion.
What's that? Yeah, more religion. Exactly. And so I talk about that in the book, how these things, and it could be, you know, and I don't criticize the winners, nor do I criticize the Oscar winners, right? Because it's really not they, you know, it's not the Oscar winners or the Nobel Prize winners who set up the system. And I don't think that people go off in their career and trumpet, you know, I'm going to try to win a Nobel Prize. But you better believe that the movie studios say, I really want my movies to win an Oscar. And I talk about in the book how, you know, every year you can see how many movies were nominated for an Academy Award or people were nominated. There's no equivalent in the Nobel Prize. You never know who's nominated. For 50 years, they keep the files sealed. It's longer sealed than the Warren Commission report on the JFK assassination was sealed. And you have to ask why. Why is there so much, you know, cloak and dagger opacity to this process, which is supposed to award, you know, superlative achievements in science? And so I think that it is to the detriment of science. And in the book, I propose five different reforms. I call it the Nobel Reformation. And, you know, when Lutheranism came to Sweden in the, you know, 1600s or whatever, the king of Sweden was very reluctant to take it on. And now it's, you know, one of the dominant religions in Sweden, to the extent that they are religious. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, I've only got five theses. You know, Martin Luther had 95. So it's a lot shorter read than Martin Luther's.
Now, remember what happened to Martin Luther.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Right, but go ahead.
So I do propose that the Nobel Prize could be used and burnished in such a way as to reform what process is in place. And in doing so, it would rectify the ills of what's happened in the past. And I think the time to reform is now because, you know, if you wait for your critics to reform you, it's not going to be as gentle a process as you're seeing in Hollywood or in politics. The Me Too movement, which is very powerful. And if that happens, if the Nobel Prize has a Me Too moment, as I suspect it will, people boycott it. All it will take is one or two people to boycott it for its lack of diversity, its lack of inclusion, its lack of completely representing the panorama of science. This will be quite detrimental to its own existence. So ironically, I don't expect the Nobel Committee. I've been in contact with several of them. They all to a person, I should say to a man, you know, because it's mostly who I've talked to. They mostly agree with my suggestions. And yet, you know, I haven't seen any. I haven't been invited to, you know, help them reform it. I don't think that they, when I did nominate the winners and they asked me to nominate the winners, it's not like they've come back for more. So and that's fine. But we've established a website. Some colleagues and I have established a website called losingthenobelprize.org where people can rectify past wrongs with the prize. And again, it's done to save the Nobel Prize, you know, not crucify it, but to resurrect it, to use religious metaphors again.
Again, religion, of course, it's a little tough for those heretic priests to change the Vatican's views on things, as we've
known. That's right.
I mean, it might be even a bigger uphill than we might think. You asked this question yourself, so I'm going to ask it too. You didn't win the Nobel Prize. You wrote a book criticizing the Nobel Prize. You write that critics might call you sour grapes. What would you say to those folks?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there have been a lot of critiques in the community of the Nobel Prize. And no one's really said, well, you didn't win it, so you can't criticize it. Just like, you know, you don't have to be a critic of, you know, you don't have to be a movie producer to criticize Harvey Weinstein. I'm not comparing at all what he did to human beings to what the Nobel Prize does. But to say that you can't criticize it unless you won it, that's a shallow argument. And to the end that I can say I didn't win it, but that's not why I wrote the book. And that's not why I, you know, have the critique that I do have. And again, I think a lot of it is done in such a way as to agitate for reform of the prize. But the last thing I would say is that I quote from many Nobel Prize winners in the book, many who say that in today's climate, they could not have won the Nobel Prize that they won. And I think that should be shocking to people. If I run a very large observatory here in San Diego with colleagues from around the world, and it's a great privilege. And if I heard, you know, some of the scientists saying on it, well, this experiment is not capable of doing what a previous experiment was capable of doing, I'd be up in arms about it, and I'd want to do everything as a leader, as a true leader, and guardian of, say, the Nobel name or my experiment, to take action. And I think they don't want to take action because they're happy with the status quo. But again, I caution, a lot of times, you know, the bubble gets to its biggest diameter right before it pops. And so right now, the Nobel prestige is at an all-time high. But, you know, the Pulitzer Prize used to be as prestigious or maybe more prestigious than the Nobel Prize in the early, you know, 1900s. The Olympics, the Oscars, they've all gone through, you know, ups and downs. And I think, you know, to treat it as if the Nobel Prize can never be changed, as if it's a law of physics and it's not subject to reformation, is just completely logically incongruous, and I don't think it's correctly representational of the integrity of modern science.
Beyond the Nobel Prize itself, what about money in science? I'm thinking that's part of the Nobel Prize. It isn't the money within the prize itself and the prestige and whatnot, but that tendrils from that are huge, right? In terms of what universities get funded and what projects might get funded. I mean, we're talking for decades ahead.
Yeah, because as I discussed, you know, the surest way to make a congressman understand, you know, that you should dedicate $1 billion to a project to listen to black holes crashing together is to say, well, look, this just won a Nobel Prize. It's sort of this inarguable ultimate A plus that even a congressman can understand. Okay, so it's no surprise that the funding agencies, then, if you go to their websites, they all have pages dedicated to how many Nobel laureates they have. You know, it would be as if you have children and you only praise them for their grades. You never praise them for their character. And it's sort of like, my child is an A plus student. Well, I mean, what about their character? Or what about, you know, the other attributes? Or what about the fact that they had 1,100 other colleagues on this project? And they didn't win the Nobel Prize. And so it's to me, it's not really a representative of how science is done today.
There's a lot of spiritual reflection in your book, including passages from the Torah, New Testament. This has been a personal, spiritual, what is my life about journey, in a sense, for you, hasn't it? So what that question and what's the prize for you now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. It was really a cathartic experience to go through both the highs and lows emotionally of being in the running, of creating this Nobel Prize winning experiment, and then to see different parts of its, you know, kind of soul stripped away and control wrested away from me and losing, you know, great colleagues in the process. But coming out of it, you know, really transformed to see, you know, on the other side is really the perspective. You know, when you're really close to the mountain, when you're really close to the promised land, so to speak, you really don't have perspective. It's too close. It's too much in your foreground. And for me, I believe that I've come out of it with a much, much deeper appreciation for both the people that came before me and taught me and taught my teachers so that I could teach on and really catalyze this notion of what it means to be a scientist is to be a teacher. And in the essence of what do I want to leave behind? You know, Alfred Nobel produced what was, you know, what we call in Judaism or even in Christianity that is known as an ethical will. And it's a divine document in a sense that what you want to be identified with, what were your core values? Who were you as a person, as in my case, as a father of biological children, as a father of intellectual children, my 9 PhD students that have gone on to get their PhDs with me, and the current 8 PhD students that I have now. It's a great privilege. It's a great burden. It's a great responsibility. But of all things, to note that the real prize is not the Stockholm destination. it's really the journey of just the wonderment and the excitement and exploring the really big questions that I think is the true privilege and the true prize that I believe I have received in the end.
Well, I'm impressed of the fact that you wrote the book after going through an experience that certainly probably was certainly a downer for you, to be able to come around and say, I'm going to make something out of this and make something better for humanity itself.
I there are a lot of books written out there, you know, how to win a Nobel Prize, you know, and they're kind of like, I joke, you know, they're kind of like how to win the lottery, because a lot of it is luck and living a long life and outlasting, you know, all but two other competitors, you know, perhaps. And so many times people write these books that are, I call victory lap books, you know, it's how I want, but how many people can really identify with that? Whereas a lot more people can identify with this notion of, well, I really, you know, I really had this goal that was all consuming and became a part of my identity, but that really isn't the pure form of who I am as a human being. And it isn't who I am in my soul. And that's what I believe, I hope. And I've been told by young readers, which was really important to me. You know, one young lady in particular dropped out of her astronomy program in college because her father told her she wouldn't be a good scientist unless she won a Nobel Prize. And it really hit me hard when she told me that she wished that my book was around, you know, 10 years ago. And I wish that it was too, because, you know, the world lost a great astronomer in her case. But I hope and I believe that my book can be useful for young students of science or even people that aspire to win great prizes in acting or in sports. And I hope that I've accomplished and been successful in that capacity.
I think you have. I think there's so much here on so many different levels to think about what really is what it means in many respects to be a human being and to search for truth and to work together and to be collaborative and to be competitive and all of the things that can set us back as well as the things that can propel us forward.
Thank you so much.
Brian Keating has been my guest. His book is called Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. Thank you, Dr. Keating, for being with me today.
Thank you so much, John. It was a real pleasure.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks to the following stations for carrying Progressive Spirit every week: WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee; WEHC, Emory, Virginia; WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina; Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown, Pennsylvania; KCEI, Taos, New Mexico; KACR, Alameda, California; WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin; KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon; KYAQ, Newport, Oregon; KZ88, Kabul, Missouri; KBOG, Bandon, Oregon; and 3A Oldies, 91.9 in Epsom, New Hampshire. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.